This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Have you ever walked past, like, a forgotten item, maybe a bike chained up, just slowly rusting away? And you kind of wonder, is that just abandoned or did someone genuinely forget where they parked?
Right, or you see a car with a smashed window and your first thought is stolen.
Exactly. But what actually counts as theft, legally, it turns out it's way more complicated than just, you know, taking something.
It really is.
So today, on the Deep Dive, that's our mission. We're going to peel back the layers on those assumptions and really unpack the surprisingly nuanced world of theft and burglary offenses.
Mm-hmm.
We'll sift through legal definitions. Some might seem a bit dense at first, fair warning, but we'll pull out the surprising details and see how these ideas play out in the real world.
Think of it like getting a solid handle on a part of the law that honestly touches everyone's lives in some way.
Yeah, a shortcut to getting properly informed.
And understanding these differences, these fine lines, it's really crucial, not just if you work in law, but for anyone, really, just to get a deeper feel for how the law works. That precise language isn't just there to be confusing, you know? It's there to define things clearly, protect rights, ensure justice. It might look overwhelming.
It can seem that way.
Definitely. But we're here to kind of walk you through it, break down each piece so you get not just what these offenses are, but why they're defined so carefully and what that means for you.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Our mission today, get past that everyday idea of taking something that isn't yours and really grasp the surprising depth, the sometimes counterintuitive nature of theft and burglary in the legal system. It's going to be quite a journey. All right, so let's start right at the beginning. The fundamental legal definition of theft often reads something like this. A person commits an offense if he unlawfully appropriates property with intent to deprive the owner of property.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that sounds, pretty straightforward, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does on the surface.
But trust me, if you're new to this, every single word in that definition, it's loaded, packed with specific legal meaning that goes way beyond how we might use those words day to day.
Precisely. Those words are the bedrock. And to really get what unlawful appropriation means, we absolutely have to break down three key terms: property, deprive, and appropriate.
Okay.
Let's start with property, because legally, it's much, much broader than just a physical thing you can hold.
Right.
It covers real property, land, buildings, tangible personal property, sure, the stuff you can touch, but also things severed from land, like timber that's been cut down or minerals dug up.
Okay, that makes sense.
But here's where it gets really expansive. It also includes intangible personal property.
Intangible, like what?
Things you can't physically touch. Think intellectual property, digital assets, even just a document that represents value, like a stock certificate or maybe a check.
Wow.
So if you thought property was just your wallet or your phone,
yeah,
the law sees it much, much bigger.
So hold on. If someone steals, say, a secret recipe, that could be property theft, just like stealing the actual sauce.
Absolutely. That's a perfect example. The legal definition is designed to protect all kinds of value, tangible or not.
Okay, that's a huge distinction right there. What about depriving? Is that just taking something permanently?
Good question. Again, it's broader than you might think. It's not just about taking it forever. The law lays out three main ways you can deprive someone.
Three ways?
Yep. First, obviously, withholding it permanently, or withholding it for so long that a major chunk of its value or the owner's enjoyment of it is just lost.
Ah, so like borrowing a classic car for months without asking, even if you give it back eventually.
Exactly. You've deprived the owner of significant use and enjoyment. Second way, restoring the property only if the owner pays you a reward or some kind of compensation.
Like holding it for ransom.
Pretty much. Demanding payment to return what's already theirs. And the third way is disposing of the property so that the owner is unlikely to get it back.
Like selling it quickly or just dumping it somewhere?
Precisely. Selling it off, ditching it where it won't be found.
Hmm.
So the surprising thing here, maybe, is that depriving isn't just about who has it physically. It's more about the impact on the owner's basic rights and access to what's legally theirs.
Okay, so it's not just losing the item, it's losing the use of it, the freedom to control it. That's subtle, but really important.
Exactly right. And then finally, appropriate. This clarifies the actual action of unlawfully getting the property. It's defined in two main ways.
Okay.
First, it's about transferring, or even just purporting to transfer, the title or some other non-possessory interest in the property, like, say, fraudulently changing a car's title into your name.
Even if you never actually touched the car itself.
Right. That act alone can be appropriation. The second way is closer to what most people think of, acquiring or otherwise exercising control over the property. But this part usually applies to property other than real estate.
So gaining physical control, basically.
Yes, getting your hands on it or acting like you own it. So appropriation isn't just grab and run. It's about asserting control or ownership you're not entitled to.
So putting it all together, if you thought theft was just physically taking something, the law sees it much more broadly. It's less about the physical act itself and more about the intent to mess with someone's ownership rights, even if you never lay a finger on the actual item.
Wow. That definitely lays a more complex foundation than I think most people realize.
And in building right on that foundation, that whole idea of unlawful appropriation, it almost always hinges on one key thing, the absence of effective consent.
Okay, effective consent. So if the owner actually agreed, it's not theft.
Generally, yes. But effective consent itself has a very specific legal definition. It's not just any yes. It means consent given by someone who is legally authorized to act for the owner.
So not just anyone can give permission.
Exactly. It has to be the owner or someone they've legally empowered, like someone with power of attorney.
Okay.
Now, this is where it gets really interesting. The law gets super specific about when consent is not effective. And this is often what turns something that looks consensual into actual theft.
Like what invalidates consent? Well, several things. Consent isn't effective if it's induced by deception or coercion. Pretty straightforward. If someone tricks you or forces you, your yes doesn't count legally.
Makes sense.
Also, if it's given by someone the actor knows isn't legally authorized, you can't just take something from a kid who says, okay, if you know they don't have the right to give it away.
Right. You can't exploit that.
Precisely. And it's not effective if given by someone who, maybe due to youth or a mental disease or defect or intoxication, is known by the actor to be unable to make reasonable decisions about property.
Protecting vulnerable people.
Exactly. Same goes if the person giving consent is known to have diminished capacity because of advanced age. And here's a really crucial one, especially for law enforcement.
Okay.
Consent given solely to detect the commission of an offense. That's not effective consent.
Ah, so that's how undercover stings work.
Mm.
The officer pretending to be a victim or buyer isn't actually giving real consent.
Exactly. Their consent is just for the purpose of the investigation. It doesn't make the crime lawful.
Wow, okay. Given how vital effective consent is, I'm really curious about how it gets undermined. You mentioned deception. That seems key. And like everything else, I bet deception isn't just telling a simple lie in legal terms.
You bet right. It's way more complex. The law actually details five distinct ways deception can happen. And understanding these is vital because they often draw that line between, say, a business deal gone bad and actual criminal fraud.
Five ways. Let's hear them.
Okay. First, actively creating or confirming a false impression about law or fact, something that's likely to affect someone's judgment in a deal, and crucially, the actor knows it's false. It's deliberate misrepresentation.
Got it. Actively misleading.
Second, failing to correct a false impression you previously created or confirmed once you know it's false, if it's still likely to affect judgment. So staying silent when you know you misled someone earlier, that can be deception too.
Okay, so an omission can be deceptive.
Yes. Third, preventing someone else from getting information that would likely affect their judgment in a transaction. So actively hiding the truth.
Right. blocking access to facts.
Fourth, and this is a big one, selling or transferring property without disclosing things like liens, security interests, or other legal claims against it, even if the claim isn't perfectly valid or recorded yet.
Like selling a car without mentioning the outstanding loan on it?
Textbook example.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
And finally, fifth, promising to do something that's likely to affect someone's judgment in a deal when you actually have no intention of doing it or you know you won't do it.
So promising future performance, you know you won't deliver.
Exactly. But there's a critical catch here. Just failing to perform a promise later on isn't enough proof on its own. You can't just point to a broken contract and say deception.
Ah, okay. So you need more evidence of the intent at the time the promise was made.
Precisely. You need to show they never intended to follow through from the beginning.
That makes sense. It prevents every breach of contract from becoming a criminal case.
Exactly. This level of detail in defining effective consent and deception is so important because it really draws that line between a civil dispute, like a disagreement over money or a contract, and a criminal act of theft. Criminal theft hinges on undermining the owner's true intent or their actual legal ability to consent. This precision helps make sure the law targets real criminal intent, not just business deals gone wrong or misunderstandings.
Okay, so we've covered unlawful appropriation when effective consent is missing, often because of deception. But you mentioned the definition covers other scenarios too.
That's right. Beyond lack of effective consent, the law defines unlawful appropriation in two other key ways, which are really important for understanding how theft is often investigated and proven.
What were they?
The first is appropriating property knowing it was stolen by someone else.
Ah, so receiving stolen goods or fencing.
Exactly. Even if you didn't steal it originally, possessing it knowing it's hot is still unlawful appropriation under the theft statute.
Okay. And the second?
The second involves appropriating property that has been explicitly represented as stolen by a law enforcement agency.
Another one for sting operations.
Precisely. The property doesn't actually have to be stolen. If law enforcement tells a suspect it's stolen to gauge their intent and the suspect takes it, that's appropriation. It focuses on the suspect's criminal mindset.
That's a powerful tool. But how does the law determine knowledge in these cases? Like knowing it was stolen by someone else. Does the person have to admit they knew?
Not always. And this is where it gets really interesting. The law allows for presumptions of knowledge in certain specific situations.
Presumptions? Meaning the law assumes they knew.
Essentially, yes. Based on the circumstances, the law can say, given these facts, we presume you knew, or at least you should have known, the property was stolen. It then shifts the burden slightly to the defendant to explain why they didn't know.
Wow. Okay, let's dig into these presumptions. They sound incredibly specific.
They are. They offer a fascinating look into areas where fencing stolen goods is common, and they put a real burden on certain businesses to be diligent.
Like who?
Well, take businesses dealing in used or secondhand property. If they buy something for $25 or more, the law presumes they knew it was stolen. If they knowingly or recklessly fail to do certain things,
such as
fail to record the seller's ID info, name, address, ID number, failed to get a complete description of the property, including serial numbers if it has them, or failed to get a signed warranty from the seller saying they actually have the right to possess and sell it.
So pawn shops, secondhand dealers, they have to be really careful with their paperwork.
Absolutely. The law basically says, if you're not doing this basic diligence, we're going to assume you're turning a blind eye or worse.
Okay. What other businesses fall under these presumptions?
Businesses dealing with abandoned or wrecked motor vehicles or their parts, think salvage yards, dismantlers, they face even stricter requirements.
To prevent shops from laundering stolen parts.
Exactly. They're presumed to know property is stolen if they fail to maintain meticulous inventory records. Date of purchase, seller info, VIN from the original vehicle, description of the parts. It's all about creating a paper trail.
Makes sense.
They're also presumed to know if they fail to get the proper paperwork, like certificates of authority, sales receipts, or titles showing no liens. And here's a really specific one.
Yeah.
They have to immediately remove unexpired license plates from vehicles they receive, secure them, and keep an inventory of those plates on official state DMV forms. If they fail on that, presumption of knowledge.
Wow, that is incredibly detailed. It's like the law is saying, if you're not doing all of this, you're either incompetent or you're in on it.
That's pretty much the message. And it extends beyond businesses. Even individuals buying a used car face presumptions.
How so?
If you knowingly or recklessly fail to report into the DMV if the seller doesn't give you a properly executed title, or if you don't file the registration and title with the county within 20 days, the law can presume you knew it was stolen.
So the burden's really on the buyer to make sure everything is legit.
It is. And it gets even more noosh. Buying certain restricted use pesticides from someone without a license? Same deal, failure to record seller info, description, and get that warranty means a presumption of knowledge.
Okay, I'm definitely seeing the pattern. High-risk goods, specific procedures required. Failure means presumed knowledge.
You got it. There's also one for livestock dealers under Federal X. Failure to pay promptly after promising to do so can be presumed deception. And a very current one. Possessing catalytic converters that have been removed from a vehicle.
Yeah, that's a huge problem now.
Right. You're presumed to have appropriated them unlawfully unless you're the owner of the car they came from, or you possess them as part of your legitimate business, like a mechanic or recycler.
That directly targets that specific type of theft.
Exactly. These presumptions show how the law adapts. They're not just about catching people red-handed. They create a framework to tackle common ways stolen goods are moved and laundered, and they place a clear responsibility on those involved in certain transactions to act diligently. Ignorance isn't always an excuse when the law requires you to take specific steps.
Okay, so we understand what constitutes theft, including these presumptions. Now let's talk consequences. You mentioned the theft ladder earlier. That's about punishment levels, right? And it's mostly based on value.
Primarily, yes. The severity of the theft offense, and therefore the potential punishment, climbs a ladder based mainly on the value of the property or service stolen. Higher value generally means a higher rung on the ladder, tougher penalties.
So how is value determined? Is it just what something costs new?
Not necessarily. The main standard is the fair market value of the property at the time and place the theft occurred. Basically, what could it have reasonably been sold for then and there?
Okay, market value. What if you can't figure that out, like for something unique?
Good point. If the fair market value can't be reasonably figured out, the law then looks to the replacement cost. What would it cost the owner to replace that item within a reasonable time after the theft?
All right. What about documents? Like stealing a check or an IOU, is the value just the paper?
No, it's about the financial impact. For something like evidence of a debt, the value is the amount due and collectible, minus anything already paid. For other documents, it's the greatest amount of economic loss the owner might reasonably suffer because they lost that specific document. It's about the potential harm.
Okay. And what if the value is just totally unclear, impossible to determine?
In those rare cases where value just can't be reasonably ascertained by any standard method, the law sets a default range. It's deemed to be $750 or more, but less than $2,500.
Which puts it at what level?
That lands it right at the threshold between a Class A misdemeanor and a state jail felony. And here's an interesting wrinkle. If the person accused of theft can actually prove by a preponderance of the evidence, meaning it's more likely than not that they had some legal interest in the property or maybe they paid something for it, that amount they had an interest in or paid gets deducted from the total value when determining the offense level.
So it acknowledges partial ownership or payment.
Exactly. Now, related to value, there's a really crucial concept called aggregation.
Aggregation? What's that?
This is huge. The law allows prosecutors to add up the values of multiple thefts if they were committed as part of one single scheme or a continuing course of conduct.
Even if the thefts were from different people or places?
Yes. Whether from one victim multiple times or several different victims, if it's all part of the same ongoing plan or spree, the amounts can be combined aggregated to reach a higher total value.
Why is that so important?
It prevents criminals from gaming the system by committing lots and lots of small thefts, each one maybe just a misdemeanor, to deliberately avoid facing a more serious felony charge. Aggregation says, no, we see the bigger pattern here. This is a felony-level operation, even if each individual...
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Individual act was small. It really targets persistent or organized criminal behavior.
Got it. So aggregation stops people from flying under the radar with lots of minor offenses. Makes sense. Okay, so with value and aggregation in mind, can you walk us through the basic rungs of that theft ladder? What are the general punishment categories based on value?
Sure. It starts low and climbs steadily. Remember, these are general guidelines, and as we'll discuss, other factors can change things.
Yeah.
But based purely on value.
Okay.
Less than $100. That's typically a Class C misdemeanor. Think minor shoplifting.
Right.
$100 up to, but not including, $750. So that's usually a Class B misdemeanor.
Okay.
$750 up to, but not including, $2,500. Now you're at a Class A misdemeanor.
You're getting more serious.
$2,500 up to, but not including, $30,000. That's a state jail felony. This is where you cross into felony territory.
Big jump.
$30,000 up to, but not including, $150,000. That's a third degree felony.
Yeah.
$150,000 up to, but not including, $300,000. Second degree felony.
Serious time.
And finally, $300,000 or more. That's a first degree felony, the highest level for theft based on value alone.
Wow. Okay. So that's the basic ladder. But you mentioned other factors.
Yes. And this is where it gets really fascinating. Certain specific items that are stolen or specific circumstances surrounding the theft can dramatically bump the offense level up the ladder, sometimes completely irrespective of the actual monetary value.
Like enhancements.
Exactly. Think of them as plus one enhancements or specific item triggers. They really show what society, through the law, deems particularly important to protect or particularly harmful to discourage beyond just the dollar amount.
Okay, give me some examples. What items automatically raise the stakes?
All right. Stealing a driver's license or a state-issued personal ID card. Even though its replacement cost is low, that theft is automatically a Class B misdemeanor.
Because of the potential for identity theft.
Precisely. Also, remember we talked about repeat offenders. Any theft, even under $100, which would normally be Class C, becomes a Class B misdemeanor if the person has any prior theft conviction.
Okay, so priors matter quickly. What bumps things up to a felony level, regardless of low value?
Several things make it a state jail felony automatically. Stealing any firearm is one.
Regardless of its value. Makes sense for safety.
Definitely. Stealing an official election ballot or its carrier envelope, that protects the voting process.
Critical.
Theft from the person of another, like pickpocketing. Theft from a human corpse or a grave, including military markers. Those show a profound disrespect that the law punishes more severely.
Yeah, definitely.
Also, if the value is under $2,500, but the person has two or more prior theft convictions, it jumps to a state jail felony. Stealing certain amounts of metals like aluminum, bronze, copper, or brass, even if valued under $20,000, can also trigger a state jail felony, likely targeting infrastructure theft.
Okay, so specific items, prior convictions, what about higher felony levels?
For a third degree felony, it can be triggered by stealing certain livestock, cattle, horses, exotic livestock, even if valued under $150,000. Same for stealing 10 or more sheep, swine, or goats under that value, protecting agriculture.
Right.
Also, stealing controlled substances valued under $150,000 from specific places like pharmacies, hospitals, or wholesale distributor vehicles. That's a third degree felony too. targeting drug diversion.
Got it. And second degree?
Stealing an ATM or its contents or components if valued under $300,000, that jumps straight to a second degree felony, reflects the damage and potential violence involved.
Okay, so those are specific items. What about those general plus one enhancements you mentioned, the ones that bump any offense up one category?
Right. These apply across a range of theft offenses, from Class C misdemeanors up through second-degree felonies, pushing them to the next higher category. They really highlight specific societal concerns.
Like what kind of concerns?
Public trust, for one. If the thief was a public servant and used their position to access the property, plus one level, same if they had a government contract and got access that way.
Holding officials accountable.
Exactly. Protecting vulnerable groups is another big one. If the owner of the stolen property was an elderly individual or a nonprofit organization, plus one level.
That's significant. Shows the law values protecting those groups more.
Absolutely. There's even one for Medicare providers who steal through their government contract relationship, targeting healthcare fraud.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any others? What about how the theft happens?
Yes. If, during the theft, the person intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly does certain things related to security systems, plus one level, causing a fire exit alarm to go off, deactivating or preventing a fire exit alarm or a retail theft detector from working, or using one of those shielding or deactivation instruments we talked about earlier, like a booster bag, any of those actions bumps the penalty up.
So directly targeting the methods used in, say, organized retail theft.
Precisely. And there's one more very specific plus one enhancement I should mention.
Go ahead.
It applies to state jail felonies through second degree felonies involving stolen catalytic converters. If the thief possessed a firearm during that specific offense, the punishment gets bumped up to the next higher category.
Wow, a direct response to the violence sometimes seen with those thefts.
Exactly. It shows the law adapting to current specific crime trends and their associated dangers.
These enhancements, both for specific items and general circumstances, really paint a picture, don't they? The law isn't just looking at dollars and cents. It's actively trying to protect vulnerable people, safeguard public trust, and clamp down on specific types of crime that cause particular harm or use particularly disruptive methods. It's way more dynamic than just a simple value ladder. Okay, let's pivot now from that general theft framework to some really specialized theft offenses. These have their own unique definitions and punishments, right? Because the nature of what's stolen or how it's stolen is different.
Exactly. The general theft statute covers a lot, but some things are specific enough to warrant their own section.
Like what? Let's start with something maybe less tangible, but incredibly valuable. Trade secrets. How does the law handle theft of trade secrets?
Right. This is critical in the business world.
Right.
First, you need the definitions. An article here can be any object, material, or device, or a copy of it. Think writings, recordings, drawings, samples. A copy is just what it sounds like, a replica, or even notes or sketches made from an article.
And the key one, trade secret.
A trade secret is defined as scientific or technical info, a design, process, formula, or improvement that, number one, has value, and number two, importantly, the owner has taken reasonable measures to keep it from becoming public knowledge.
Ah, so the owner has to actively protect it for it to count legally as a secret.
Precisely. That reasonable measures part is crucial. So given that, a person commits this offense if, without the owner's effective consent, they knowingly do one of three things. Steal the trade secret itself, make a copy of an article representing the trade secret, or communicate or transmit the trade secret to someone else.
Pretty broad coverage, stealing, copying, or sharing.
Yes, and the punishment reflects its seriousness. Theft of trade secrets is always a third-degree felony, period, regardless of the supposed value of the secret.
Wow, always a felony. That sends a strong message about protecting intellectual property.
Definitely.
Okay, what's next? Something more. Physical.
How about theft of petroleum product?
Okay, that sounds specific. Why single that out from general theft?
Good question. It's largely because of the immense value involved, the critical nature of these resources for infrastructure and the economy, and the often large-scale, sophisticated methods used to steal them. Think tapping pipelines, siphoning tanks.
Right, not your average shoplifting. So what counts as a petroleum product here?
The law specifies crude oil, natural gas, or condensate.
Okay. And how is the theft committed?
It's unlawfully appropriating the product with intent to deprive by either possessing, removing, delivering, receiving, buying, selling, moving, concealing, or transporting it, or by making a connection to, drilling into, or tapping a pipeline or storage tank. It covers the whole chain from tapping the source to moving the stolen product.
And the punishment, is it value-based, like general theft?
Yes. It follows a value ladder, but with its own specific tiers reflecting the potentially huge amounts involved. It starts as a state jail felony if the value is less than $10,000 and can go all the way up to a first-degree felony if the value hits $300,000 or more.
Okay, so high stakes for high-value resources. Makes sense. Let's move on to something maybe more relatable for many people. Mail theft.
Ah, yes. A growing concern, especially with identity theft.
Exactly. This isn't just about losing a package, is it? It can have major knock-on effects if personal info is involved. First, how is mail defined?
It's basically any sealed letter, package, or item delivered by a common carrier, like the Postal Service or UPS, that hasn't yet been received by the addressee, or mail that's been left out for collection.
Okay, and what about identifying information? That seems key here.
Very key. It's defined broadly, much like in identity theft laws. It includes things like name and date of birth, unique biometric data like fingerprints, electronic IDs, account numbers, social security numbers, basically any info commonly used to commit identity fraud.
Got it. So what are the elements of the crime itself?
Pretty straightforward. Intentionally appropriating mail from someone else's mailbox or premises without the addressee's effective consent and with the intent to deprive them of that mail.
Okay. Now, the punishment here is interesting, right? It's not based on the value of the mail.
You're right. It's uniquely based on the number of different addressees whose mail was stolen.
How does that scale work?
Fewer than 10 addressees. Class A misdemeanor. 10 up to but not including 30 addressees. State jail felony. 30 or more addressees, third-degree felony.
So targeting multiple victims ramps up the penalty quickly.
Yes. But it gets even more serious if identity theft is involved.
How so?
If it's proven at trial that the stolen mail contained identifying information and the thief intended to use that info to commit identity theft under Section 32.51 of the code, the penalties escalate dramatically based on the number of addressees.
How high can it go?
It starts as a state jail felony for fewer than 10 addressees with ID info and intent, but can climb all the way to a first-degree felony if it involves 50 or more addressees under those circumstances.
First-degree felony for mail theft. That's huge.
It shows how seriously the law takes identity theft facilitated through mail. And there's one more enhancement.
What's that?
If the actor knew or had reason to believe that an addressee was elderly or disabled, the penalty gets bumped up one level higher again.
Extra protection for vulnerable groups.
Exactly. It really highlights how the law adapts, recognizing that stealing information can be far more damaging than stealing the physical mail itself. It views mail theft, especially involving ID info, not just as a property crime, but as a potential gateway to much more devastating fraud.
Okay, let's shift to retail. We hear a lot about organized shoplifting rings, those flash mob type events.
Mm-hmm.
The law has something specific for that, separate from just one person shoplifting, right?
Yes, that's organized retail theft.
What does that involve?
A person commits this if they intentionally conduct, promote, or facilitate an activity where they receive, possess, conceal, sell, or dispose of stolen retail merchandise. It also covers situations where merchandise is explicitly represented as stolen retail merchandise, again, for those undercover buys.
Okay. And the punishment?
It generally follows the standard theft ladder based on the total value of the merchandise involved.
But are there specific enhancements given the organized nature?
Absolutely. The penalty gets bumped up to the next higher category if the actor organized, supervised, financed, or managed one or more other people in the theft ring. That targets the leaders.
Makes sense.
And remember those plus one enhancements we talked about earlier for disrupting security, setting off fire alarms, disabling theft detectors, using shielding devices? If anyone involved in the organized retail theft does those things, the penalty for the organizer can also be enhanced.
So it connects the disruptive tactics back to the organizers.
Exactly. It aims to dismantle the entire operation. And related to this, there is a separate offense for the tools used.
What?
Possession, manufacture, or distribution of retail theft instruments.
Okay, what does that cover?
Committing this offense means either possessing a shielding or deactivation instrument with the intent to commit theft, or knowingly manufacturing, selling, offering for sale, or distributing one of those instruments.
And the penalty for just having or making the tool?
That's a Class A misdemeanor.
So this raises that question again. What exactly is a shielding or deactivation instrument in this context?
Typically, it's something specifically designed to defeat store security systems. The classic example is a booster bag, a shopping bag lined with foil, or another material to block the signals from electronic security tags. Or it could be a device used to illegally remove or deactivate those tags. The law gets specific to combat these evolving criminal tools.
Okay, let's talk vehicles again, but from a slightly different angle.
Yeah.
Unauthorized use of a vehicle. How is this different from regular auto theft?
The key difference is usually the intent. In standard auto theft, under the general theft statute, the prosecution typically needs to prove the intent to permanently deprive the owner. Unauthorized use of a vehicle, or UUV, often covers situations like joyriding, where the intent might just be temporary use, not permanent keeping.
So it's about the operation without permission, not necessarily keeping it forever.
Exactly. The elements are intentionally or knowingly operating another person's boat, airplane, or motor-propelled vehicle without the owner's effective consent. The focus is on the unauthorized operation itself.
And the punishment for UUV.
It's a state jail felony, so still serious, even if the intent wasn't permanent deprivation.
Okay. What about situations involving debt and property used as collateral, like someone trying to hide a car they still owe money on?
Yes. That falls under hindering secured creditors. This protects lenders who have a legal interest, like a lien, on property.
How does it work?
There are two main ways to commit this. First, if you've signed a security agreement, like a car loan or mortgage, and with the intent to hinder the lender from enforcing their lien, you destroy, remove, conceal, sell, or otherwise harm or reduce the value of that property.
How do they prove intent?
There's a presumption. If part of the debt was due, you failed to pay, and you failed to deliver the property after the lender legally demanded it back, the law presumes you intended to hinder them.
Okay. And the second way?
This applies if you're a debtor who doesn't have the right to sell the secured property, or you're supposed to account for the proceeds if you do sell it. If you sell or dispose of it anyway, or don't account for the proceeds, with the intent to appropriate those proceeds, basically keep the money you were entitled to, that's also hindering secured creditors.
Is there a presumption there, too?
Yes. Intent to appropriate the proceeds is presumed if you don't hand them over or account for them within 10 days after the secured party makes a lawful demand.
And the punishment for hindering creditors?
It follows the general theft ladder based on the value of the property involved. So the more valuable the collateral you're hiding or disposing of, the more serious the charge. It's all about protecting the integrity of those secured financial transactions.
Right. One more specific theft type. Theft of service. This isn't about a physical item, is it? It's about getting services without paying.
Exactly. And service is defined really broadly in the law.
Like what counts as a service?
It includes labor, professional services, like from a lawyer or accountant, telecom services, utilities like electricity or water, transportation services, lodging, hotels, motels, restaurant meals, entertainment, and even renting things like cars or equipment.
Okay, pretty much anything you pay for that isn't a physical good you take home. So how do you commit theft of service?
The core idea is intending to avoid payment for a service you know you have to pay for. You can do this by securing the service through deception, threat, or using a false token, like a slug in a machine, or by diverting services you control but aren't entitled to for your own benefit or someone else's.
Okay, what else?
Holding onto rental property beyond the agreed-upon rental period without the owner's consent. Or securing the service by agreeing to pay, getting the service, receiving notice demanding payment, and then still failing to make the full payment.
That last one sounds like it could cover a lot of disputes. How do they prove the intent to avoid payment versus just being unable to pay later?
That's where, again, legal presumptions become crucial. The law sets out specific situations where intent to avoid payment is presumed.
Such as?
Absconding without paying, where payment is normally immediate, think skipping out on a hotel bill or a restaurant check. That presumes intent.
Okay, the classic dine and dash.
Right. Failing to pay under a service agreement within 10 days after receiving written notice demanding payment. That presumes intent, too.
So ignoring the bill after being formed.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you.
Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Fully notified.
Yes. And there are very specific ones for rental property. Returning rental property late and then failing to pay the overdue charges within 10 days of notice. Presumed intent.
Okay.
Or failing to return rental property at all after receiving notice within specific time frames based on the property's value. That also presumes intent. The deadlines are tight. 5 days for property under $2,500, 3 days for $2,500, $10,000, and just 2 days if it's over $10,000.
Wow, they don't give you much time once notice is sent.
Not much. And for rent to own property, failing to return it within 5 business days of notice if you've made fewer than 3 full payments. Presumed intent again.
This brings us to that real-world example you mentioned, the car rental problem. It sounds like a perfect storm of these rules.
It really is. It perfectly illustrates that line between a civil contract dispute and a criminal act. A rental car isn't automatically considered stolen in the criminal sense just because it's overdue.
Right. So what has to happen for it to become criminal theft of service?
The rental company typically has to follow very specific legal steps, mainly involving sending proper written notice demanding the return of the vehicle.
Like registered mail.
Often, yes.
Yeah.
Registered or certified mail or a commercial delivery service sent to the address on the rental agreement. The law even specifies when that notice is presumed to be received, usually within 2 or 5 days.
So an officer might stop an overdue rental car, but it's still just a civil issue at that point.
Often, yes. Until the rental company has jumped through those legal hoops and officially filed a theft report, the officer might just document it as a contract violation, not make a theft arrest. It has to cross that threshold based on the company following the legal notice requirements.
That's fascinating. So the paperwork and process are everything in shifting it from civil to criminal.
Absolutely. It's also worth noting, for service generally, that just making a partial payment for something like wages isn't enough on its own to negate the intent to avoid paying the full amount due.
Is there any defense specific to theft of service?
There is one mentioned. If you secured the service using a post-dated check, and the check was presented for payment before the date written on it, that can be a defense.
Okay. And the punishment for theft of service?
Like general theft, it follows the standard theft ladder based on the value of the service that was unlawfully obtained.
All right, let's switch gears now. We've covered taking property and services, but what about illegally entering places with criminal intent? That brings us to burglary. And I imagine, like theft, the definitions here are really specific.
Very specific. Especially regarding what counts as a place and what counts as entry.
Okay, let's start with the places. What are the key definitions?
First, habitation. This isn't just a house. It's defined as a structure or vehicle that's adapted for the overnight accommodation of persons.
Adapted for overnight. So like an RV or a houseboat can count.
Exactly. And it includes not just the main structure, but also any separately secured parts of it and any connected structures like an attached garage or maybe a nearby shed used with the house.
Okay. What about places that aren't for sleeping?
That's usually covered by building. This is defined as any enclosed structure intended for use as a habitation or for purposes like trade, manufacturing, or really any other use. So stores, factories, offices, warehouses, pretty much any enclosed structure.
Got it. And vehicle.
For burglary purposes, a vehicle is any device used to move people or property unless it already qualifies as a habitation. Mm. So your standard car, truck, van things, not typically adapted for overnight living.
Okay. Habitation, building, vehicle. Now, the really interesting one.
Yeah.
What counts as enter for burglary? Do you have to actually walk inside?
No. And this surprises a lot of people. The legal definition of enter for burglary is extremely broad. It means intruding with any part of the body or are any physical object connected with the body.
Whoa. So just reaching an arm through an open window counts?
Yes. Or even just pushing a tool like a crowbar through the plane of a doorway or window.
Right.
If any part of you or something connected to you crosses that threshold without permission, that's legally an entry.
You don't have to be fully inside at all. That really lowers the bar for the act itself.
It does. It focuses on breaching the security of the structure.
Okay. With those definitions, habitation, building, vehicle, and that broad enter, let's look at the main burglary offense, section 30.02. How is it committed?
A person commits burglary if, without the owner's effective consent, they do one of three things.
Okay, what's the first?
First, they enter a habitation or a building or a part of it not open to the public, with the intent to commit a felony, theft, or an assault inside.
So the intent at the moment of entry is key there.
Absolutely. What did they plan to do once they crossed that threshold?
What's the second way?
Second, they remain concealed in a building or habitation with the intent to commit a felony, theft, or an assault. Think hiding in a store until after it closes.
Okay. So entry might have been legal initially, but staying hidden with bad intent makes it burglary.
Correct. And the third way. Third, they enter a building or habitation and commit or attempt to commit a felony, theft, or an assault.
So in this case, maybe the initial intent upon entry wasn't clear, but they actually did commit or tried to commit a crime once inside.
Exactly. The commission or attempt of the underlying crime fulfills that element.
Okay. Now, how does the punishment work for burglary? Does it vary?
Yes. It varies significantly based on the type of place and the intent.
How so?
Burglary of a building, that's not a habitation. That's generally a state jail felony.
Okay. What about a home?
Burglary of a habitation, that's automatically more serious. A second-degree felony reflects the higher violation of personal security.
Makes sense. Are there other specific circumstances?
Yes. If the place burglarized is a commercial building specifically used for storing controlled substances, like a pharmacy or hospital warehouse A&D, the intent was to steal those controlled substances. That becomes a third-degree felony, targeting drug theft again.
Okay. And the most serious?
It becomes a first-degree felony, the highest level if it's burglary of a habitation A&D. Any person involved entered with the intent to commit or actually committed or attempted a felony other than felony theft.
Ah, so breaking into a home to commit a violent felony, like assault or worse. That's the top tier.
Exactly. That distinction is critical. Burglary with intent to commit serious violence carries the gravest penalty. Personal safety is paramount.
Okay, that covers buildings and habitations.
Yeah.
What about cars? We hear about car break-ins all the time. Is that a separate offense?
Yes, that's burglary of vehicles, section 30.04. It's treated separately, generally as less severe than burglarizing a building or home, but still a significant crime.
How is it defined?
A person commits it if, without the owner's effective consent, they break into or enter a vehicle or any part of a vehicle with the intent to commit any felony or theft.
Does enter mean the same thing here? Any body part or connected object?
Yes. The exact same definition of enter applies. Reaching into an open window, using a tool to pop a lock that counts. The law also specifically notes that a container or trailer being carried on a rail car is considered part of the rail car for this offense.
Okay. What's the usual punishment for breaking into a car?
It's generally a Class A misdemeanor. However, if someone has a prior conviction for the same offense, burglary of vehicles, there's a minimum 6-month jail sentence required.
So repeat car break-ins get tougher consequences. Does it ever become a felony?
Yes. It bumps up to a state jail felony if the person has 2 or more prior convictions for burglary of vehicles, or if the vehicle they broke into was a rail car.
Rail car makes it a felony. Interesting. Why?
Likely due to the connection with cargo and commerce, potential for higher value goods inside.
Okay. Any other felony triggers for vehicle burglary?
Yes. One more. It becomes a third degree felony if the vehicle broken into is owned or operated by a wholesale distributor of prescription drugs, and D, the intent was to steal a controlled substance. Again, targeting pharmaceutical theft, even from vehicles.
Is there any specific defense mentioned for burglary of vehicles?
Just one narrow one. If the actor entered a rail car, but was an employee or representative exercising a right under the Federal Railway Labor Act.
Okay. Now, you mentioned rail cars and cargo. Is there a specific offense for cargo theft itself? It seems related, but maybe broader.
Yes, absolutely. Cargo theft, section 31.188, is a specialized offense that can involve very significant values and often organized crime.
What exactly counts as cargo?
The law defines it as goods making up a commercial shipment of freight, which is currently moving in commerce. And moving in commerce means it's anywhere between its origin and final destination, even if it's temporarily stopped for transfer or other reasons. Basically, goods in the supply chain.
Got it. So how is cargo theft committed?
Two main ways. First, knowingly or intentionally conducting, promoting, or facilitating activity where you receive, possess, conceal, sell, or dispose of stolen cargo, or cargo represented as stolen. This targets the whole network involved in moving stolen goods.
Okay. And the second way?
This one targets drivers specifically. If you're employed or contracted to drive a specific cargo shipment and with intent to commit cargo theft, you knowingly or intentionally either fail to deliver the entire load or cause the vehicle seal or an intermodal container seal to be broken with cargo missing.
So drivers stealing the goods they're supposed to be delivering.
Exactly. The punishment for cargo theft is value-based, similar to the general theft ladder, but with higher thresholds reflecting the typical value of cargo. It starts as a state jail felony for values between $1,500 and $10,000 and can go up to a first-degree felony for values over $200,000.
And does the value calculation include anything else?
Yes. Importantly, it includes the value of any vehicle that was stolen or damaged during the same criminal episode. That can bump the value up significantly.
Is there an enhancement for organizers?
Yes. Like organized retail theft, the offense level for cargo theft increases to the next higher category if the actor organized, supervised, financed, or managed one or more others involved.
And what about undercover operations? Is that a defense?
Explicitly not a defense. The law states that deception or strategy by law enforcement, like using undercover ops or bait trucks, cannot be used as a defense to cargo theft.
Okay. One last burglary type sounds minor, but probably common. Burglary of coin-operated or coin collection machines.
Right. Section 30.03. This covers things like vending machines, arcade games, laundry machines, payphones, etc.
How is it defined?
Simply, without the owner's effective consent, breaking or entering any coin-operated or coin collection machine with the intent to get property or services out of it.
Does entry have a special meaning here?
It just says every kind of entry except one made with effective consent. So again, pre-broad. Prying it open, inserting a tool.
And the punishment?
It's a Class A misdemeanor. It's an example of the law addressing a very specific common type of nuisance crime with its own tailored statute. #Taxistics, related offenses and crucial legal concepts. Okay, moving beyond direct theft and burglary, let's touch on some really important related offenses and legal concepts. These often deal with the tools used for crime or the attempts to commit crime, recognizing that the law punishes more than just the completed act.
Right, like the instruments used. What's the main offense for that?
That would be unlawful use of criminal instrument or mechanical security device, section 16.01. This gets at the tools of the trade.
What qualifies as a criminal instrument? It sounds broad.
It is pretty broad. It's defined as anything whose possession, manufacture, or sale isn't already an offense in itself that is specially designed, made, or adapted for use in committing any crime.
Can you give examples?
Sure. Those foil-lined booster bags for shoplifting could qualify. A GPS jammer intended to block tracking during a car theft. Even specially built hidden compartments in a vehicle designed to smuggle illegal goods. Maybe even instructions found online on how to commit a specific crime if adapted for use.
Okay, and what's a mechanical security device?
That refers specifically to devices used by locksmiths to gain entry, things like lock picks or Slim Jims, when possessed with criminal intent by someone who isn't a locksmith working legitimately.
Got it. So how do you commit the offense? Is just having the tool enough?
Not quite. You need intent. You commit the offense if you possess one of these instruments or devices with the intent to use it to commit a crime.
So possession plus intent.
Right. Or if you manufacture, adapt, sell, install, or set up such an instrument or device knowing its criminal character and intending that it be used by you or someone else to commit an offense. This covers the makers and suppliers too.
What's the punishment for this?
It depends. For just possessing the instrument with intent, the punishment is generally one category lower than the offense you intended to commit with it.
So if you intend to commit a felony, possessing the tool is a lower felony or misdemeanor.
Exactly. But for manufacturing, selling, adapting, etc., that's always a state jail felony, regardless of the intended crime's severity. The law takes making and distributing these tools very seriously.
How does this compare to that retail theft instrument offense we talked about earlier? That was just a Class A misdemeanor.
Good point. The retail theft instrument offense is much narrower, specifically for tools designed to defeat retail security tags. This criminal instrument offense is far broader, applies to tools for any crime, and often carries higher potential penalties.
That makes sense. Now, what about when someone tries to commit a crime, like theft or burglary, but doesn't actually succeed?
That's where criminal attempt, section 15.01, comes in.
How is attempt defined legally? You can't just be thinking about it, right?
Right. You need two things. First, the specific intent to commit a particular offense. Second, you have to do an act that amounts to more than mere preparation. It has to be a substantial step towards completing the crime that tends to affect the commission, but ultimately fails.
More than mere preparation. That sounds like a key phrase.
It is. Just buying tools or scouting a location might be preparation. Actually trying to pry open the door or pointing a weapon, that's usually more than mere preparation. It's a step towards completion.
What if the crime attempted could have been an aggravated offense, like aggravated robbery?
If the aggravating element, like using a deadly weapon, was present during the attempt, then the attempt itself is charged as an attempt of the aggravated offense.
And what if, say, someone attempts a burglary, but they actually succeed? Can they still be charged with the attempt?
Okay. Yes. It's explicitly not a defense to attempt that the crime was actually completed. The attempt itself is a separate chargeable offense.
Okay. What's the punishment for attempt?
Generally, it's one category lower than the offense that was attempted. So attempting a state jail felony burglary would be a Class A misdemeanor. Attempting a third-degree felony would be a state jail felony, and so on. But you can't attempt a Class C misdemeanor. There's no lower category.
Got it. Now, is there any way out once you've started down the path of an attempt?
Yes. There's a fascinating legal concept called the renunciation defense. Section 15.04. It's an affirmative defense, meaning the defendant has to prove it happened.
Renunciation, like genuinely changing your mind.
Pretty much. But it has to meet strict conditions. The person must have voluntarily and completely renounced their criminal objective.
Well, how do they show that?
Either by simply abandoning their conduct before the crime happens, if just stopping isn't enough to prevent it, by taking some further affirmative action that actually does prevent the crime from occurring, like maybe warning the victim or calling the police on themselves.
But it has to be voluntary, right? What if you just stop because you think you'll get caught?
Exactly. It's not considered voluntary if it's motivated, even partly by fear of getting caught or because the crime suddenly became harder to pull off. It can't be just a tactical retreat.
Or deciding to do it later, or pick an easier target.
Right. Postponing or transferring the criminal intent doesn't count as voluntary renunciation either. It has to be a genuine, complete abandonment of that specific criminal goal for reasons coming from within, not external pressures.
That sounds like a high bar to meet.
It is. But even if it doesn't fully work as a complete defense, evidence of renunciation can still be used at the punishment stage as a mitigating factor. If the jury finds renunciation occurred, the punishment must be reduced by one grade.
So it still offers some benefit, even if not a full acquittal.
Right. It incentivizes stopping before the crime is completed.
And one last thing on attempts. Can you attempt an attempt?
No. The law is clear. There's no offense for preparatory crimes like attempting an attempt or conspiring to solicit. It keeps things from getting legally absurd.
Okay, let's really dig into one specific area now. Auto theft. Our sources gave a lot of detail here, and it's such a common crime, but also surprisingly complex. It's definitely not a one-size-fits-all situation, is it?
Not at all. Investigators learn pretty quickly that there's a whole spectrum of auto thieves out there, and knowing the type helps them figure out motive, potential recovery spots, and the overall investigation strategy.
So broadly,
this podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
How do they categorize them?
Generally, you can split them into two main camps. Amateurs and professionals.
Okay, tell me about the amateurs first.
Sure. You've got your classic joyriding juveniles. They often steal a car, maybe an easy target, like one left running, drive it around for kicks with friends, and then just ditch it when they run out of gas or get bored. The motive is temporary thrill, not profit.
Right. Who else falls into the amateur category?
Transportation thieves. These are people who just need to get from point A to point B. They borrow a car, use it for transport, and then abandon it once they reach their destination, or it's no longer useful. It's about convenience, however illegal.
Okay. Any other amateurs?
The use in crime thief. They steal a vehicle specifically to use it while committing another crime, maybe a robbery, a burglary, a drive-by shooting. The car is just a tool for that other offense, and they almost always dump it quickly afterwards to avoid linking it back to them.
So for amateurs, the car itself isn't usually the end goal. It's about the ride, the transport, or using it for something else.
Pretty much. Opportunistic, often temporary.
So the professionals, that sounds like a whole different ballgame. What's their motivation? Is it always about selling the car?
Not always, but it's definitely more calculated and often profit-driven. One type is the insurance fraud swindler. This can actually be the owner themselves.
The owner? How does that work?
They might arrange for their car to be stolen or deliberately abandon it somewhere it's likely to be stripped or torched or even have it dismantled themselves. Then they file an insurance claim for the theft or total loss to collect the payout.
Wow. Okay, who else is in the professional category?
The professional auto thieves in the more traditional sense. These are often organized crews targeting specific types of vehicles, usually late model cars and trucks, often for resale. They might alter the VINs, create fake documents, and frequently ship the vehicles out of the country, especially to places with high demand and less stringent checks, like Mexico or South America. These are sophisticated operations.
Right, the export market.
And then you have strippers. These aren't usually stealing the whole car to resell. They attack parked cars, often very quickly, removing valuable, easy-to-sell parts, things like catalytic converters, airbags, wheels, stereos. They sell the parts individually or for scrap.
Quick hits for valuable components.
Exactly. And finally, the dismantlers. These are the ones running or supplying the chop shops. They steal the entire vehicle, often by towing it or hot-wiring it, drive it to a hidden location, and then completely take it apart.
Why dismantle it completely? Why not just sell the whole car?
Pure economics. The individual parts of a vehicle engine, transmission, doors, electronics, airbags sold separately on the black market can fetch significantly more money, sometimes two or three times more, than the stolen car would sell for as a whole unit. It's just much more profitable to chop it up.
That breakdown between strippers and dismantlers is interesting, different approaches to getting value from stolen vehicles. And that chop shop operation sounds like a whole process. Can you walk us through how that typically works? How do they launder a stolen car into parts and profit?
Sure. The dismantling operation is often a cycle.
Yeah.
Step one, a desirable late model vehicle is stolen. Step two, it's quickly taken to a chop shop and stripped of its most valuable, easily unidentifiable parts engines. Transmissions might have serial numbers, but seats, body panels, electronics often don't. Step three, the stripped-down shell or carcass of the vehicle is then often abandoned somewhere public, maybe on a street or in a field, for the police or owner to find.
Why abandon the shell?
So an insurance claim can be filed. Step four. The owner reports it's stolen, recovered, stripped. The insurance company pays out the claim, and the insurance company now legally owns the stripped vehicle. Step five. The insurance company sells that stripped vehicle, usually at auction, along with its title, often branded as salvage, typically for a very low price.
Okay, so the shell gets sold legally. What happens to the parts?
Step six, those parts stripped off in step two. They were either immediately used to repair other vehicles or they were warehoused. Step seven, someone, maybe the same people who stole it or another connected group, buys the legally purchased stripped shell from the insurance auction. They then rebuild it using those original stolen warehoused parts or other illicitly obtained parts. Step eight, the rebuilt vehicle, now seemingly legitimate because it have a title, albeit maybe salvage, is sold for a profit. The whole cycle effectively launders the stolen parts back into a sellable vehicle.
That's quite the system. You also mentioned something called the salvage switch. Is that different from the dismantling operation?
Yes, it's even more sophisticated in some ways. It's about giving a stolen vehicle the identity of a legally salvaged vehicle. It's identity theft for cars.
How does that work? Walk me through it.
Okay. First, you need a donor identity. A vehicle gets wrecked, burned, or maybe stripped bad enough that the insurance company declares it a total loss. That's the salvage vehicle. Second, insurance pays the owner, takes ownership of the salvage vehicle. Third, crucially, the vehicle identification number, VIN and MIM plate, is removed from this salvage vehicle. Fourth, the insurance company sells the salvage vehicle, often just the wreckage, with its title at auction. The physical wreck might even be destroyed later.
Okay, so they have a VIN and a title from a wrecked car. What next?
Simultaneously, or shortly after, a thief steals a vehicle that is the exact same make, model, and year as the salvage vehicle. Sixth, the VIN plate is removed from the stolen vehicle. Seventh, the VIN plate from the salvage vehicle is carefully installed onto the stolen vehicle. Eighth, the stolen vehicle, now bearing the VIN of the legally salvaged car, is sold using the salvage title that was acquired at the auction. voila, you have a stolen car that appears legitimate because its VIN matches a real title.
Wow. That's incredibly clever and deceptive. This is where the ingenuity of criminals really meets the complexity of vehicle identification.
It absolutely is. It creates a very convincing illusion.
So if these schemes are so sophisticated, how do investigators catch on? What are the red flags they look for to detect a salvage switch or other VIN tampering?
That's where careful police work comes in. What's fascinating is how they piece it together. One of the first steps is running the VIN or license plate through databases.
What are they looking for there?
If the VIN comes back with a junk or non-repairable salvage title status, that means the state considers it permanently non-operational if it's being driven. That's a major red flag and a registration violation right there. However, sometimes a car can be legally repaired from salvage status and get a new rebuilt title. So an officer might see brand new license plates, which could indicate a recent legitimate repair and retitling. Context is key.
Okay, so database checks are a starting point. What about physically examining the car?
That's critical because switching VIN plates often involves tampering with the plate itself or the rivets holding it in place. Officers are trained to look very closely at the dashboard VIN plate. Are the rivets damaged, incorrect, or painted over? Does the plate itself look bent, scratched, or somehow altered?
Signs of physical manipulation.
Exactly. They also compare that primary dashboard VIN with other places the VIN appears on the vehicle. Does it match the VIN on the federal safety certification label, that sticker usually on the driver's door jamb? Does it match the VIN often etched on windows or stamped on engine parts? Discrepancies are huge red flags.
You mentioned the MVI sticker too, motor vehicle inspection.
Right. Sometimes the VIN is on the MVI sticker. If a thief replaces a VIN, they might rip off the old MVI sticker. The new replacement sticker might then indicate none for the previous inspection number, which can be suspicious. These little details matter.
Where are all these VINs located? You mentioned the dash and the door sticker.
Those are the primary locations, the easiest to check. The dashboard VIN, visible through the windshield, and that federal safety label on the door jammer key. Then there are secondary locations. Manufacturers often put VIN stickers in less obvious places, like inside the trunk lid, on the glove box door, sometimes even on build sheets hidden under the hood liner or carpet. Modern cars also have anti-theft labels with partial VINs scattered on major parts.
Are there hidden ones too?
Yes, there are usually confidential VIN locations. These are stamped directly onto the vehicle's frame or unibody in places only law enforcement and manufacturers typically know. These are much harder to tamper with and are crucial for positively identifying a stolen vehicle, even if the public VINs are changed. They are not for public reports or testimony, though. An OBD scanner plugged into the car's computer can also often read the electronically stored VIN.
And is checking these VINs considered a search? Does an officer need a warrant?
That's a really important point. The law is generally clear. Securing the VIN from a vehicle is not considered a search under the Fourth Amendment. An officer can legally open the car door simply to look at the federal safety certification label on the door jamb to verify the VIN without needing separate probable cause beyond the reason for the initial stop.
That's a significant investigative tool for them.
Huge. It allows for quick verification without the hurdles of getting a warrant.
You mentioned counterfeiters making mistakes. What kind of errors give away a fake VIN plate or label?
Despite trying to be meticulous, they often slip up. Investigators look for inconsistencies. Are there misspellings in the text on the label? Is the spacing or font wrong compared to a genuine label? Are logos or symbols missing or poorly replicated? Sometimes the fake labels just feel different. Maybe they peel off too easily or the material isn't quite right. These subtle flaws can be dead giveaways.
And this all ties back to another specific offense, right? Tampering with the VIN itself.
Exactly. Tampering with identification numbers, section 31.11. This makes it illegal to knowingly or intentionally remove, alter, or obliterate the serial number or other permanent ID mark on tangible personal property, not just cars, but anything with a serial number.
Does it also cover possessing or selling tampered goods?
Yes. It's also an offense to possess, sell, or offer for sale property if, you know, or if a reasonable person should have known that the ID number was tampered with.
Are there defenses, like if you're the owner and doing repairs?
Yes, there are affirmative defenses if you are the owner or acting with the owner's consent, or if you're a peace officer doing your job, or if you're properly applying a state-assigned number.
What's the consequence if someone is caught with tampered property?
Besides the criminal charge, the property itself may be treated as stolen for legal purposes, like custody and disposal, even if it wasn't originally stolen. and the offense itself, tampering with ID numbers is a Class A misdemeanor.
Okay. Beyond the VIN itself, what other visual cues might make an officer suspect a car is stolen? Things they look for on the outside or inside?
Oh, there's a whole checklist of indicators officers are trained to spot. These are often subtle things that just seem off.
Like what on the exterior?
Obvious signs of forced entry, like broken glass, especially if a window is down on a cold or rainy day. Does the license plate actually match the vehicle description it's registered to? Does it match the last six digits of the VIN, as it often should on newer plates? Are there plates from multiple states on the same car? Is the registration sticker current and properly placed? Does the plate look suspiciously clean on a dirty car or vice versa? Is it attached loosely, maybe with wire or magnets, like someone wants to swap it quickly? Missing door locks or a punched trunk lock? A fairly new car that looks unusually beaten up or missing major parts like a tailgate or expensive wheels? Maybe it's riding on multiple mismatched spare tires?
Lots of little things that just don't add up. What about inside the car?
Similar attention to detail. The steering column is a big one. Is it broken, cracked, or covered with a towel or tape? Is the plastic housing underneath dropped down? Has the ignition cylinder itself been pulled out or damaged? Is the car running without a key in the ignition? Or if there is a key, does it look like it doesn't actually fit or operate the ignition, maybe just stuck in there as a disguise? Will the driver refuse to turn the car off? And again, checking that dashboard VIN plate, is it missing, loose, damaged, obscured, or attached with the wrong kind of rivets? Also, sometimes the contents are suspicious, and unusual abundance of valuable items like laptops or tools might suggest burglary proceeds, or conversely, missing major components like the stereo, airbags, or even third row seats might indicate the car is being stripped.
It's like being a detective, piecing together all these little clues. Now, when police recover a suspicious vehicle, it's not always clear immediately if it was stolen, impounded by the city, or maybe repossessed by a lender, right? How do they sort that out?
That's a critical step. They have procedures to follow. First, they run the vehicle's info, VIN, plate, through all the databases, local, state, TCIC, national, NCIC, checking for stolen reports and teletypes from other agencies. They need to determine the exact time and date it went missing or was reported stolen.
What else?
They also need to check internally with their own dispatch or records division to see if their agency or maybe a local towing company working for the city impounded it for parking violations or something else. They also need to check with known lien holders, if possible, to see if it was perhaps a legitimate but maybe unreported repossession.
So they have to rule out impounds and repos first.
Exactly. Only once it's definitively confirmed as stolen, based on a report and ruling out other possibilities, is it formally entered into the TCIC-NCIC system as stolen property. And then, of course, they gather all the necessary details, complete descriptions, estimated value for the official offense report. It's a process to ensure accuracy.
Let's talk about dealerships for a minute. You'd think they'd have tight security, but are they vulnerable to theft?
Surprisingly, yes. And often, the vulnerability comes from within or from their own processes. What's fascinating is how their inventory management can actually play a role.
How so?
Large dealerships, and especially rental car companies, might have huge inventories. They might only do a full physical inventory check every 30, 60, or even 90 days.
So a car could be missing for weeks or months before anyone notices.
Exactly. That gives thieves a massive head start. Also, a significant number of dealership thefts are actually inside jobs, committed or assisted by employees who know the routines, have access to keys, or can manipulate records.
Internal theft is a big risk, then.
It can be. And sometimes it's just lax procedures. Salespeople not properly tracking keys during test drives, allowing someone to easily pocket a key or make a quick duplicate to come back later.
Are there ways investigators spot cars stolen from dealerships?
Yes, there are indicators. If an officer runs a plate and the registration comes back not reported by county, that can be a flag for a recently stolen car that hasn't been titled yet. Tampered, outdated, or obviously fake temporary buyer tags are another sign. A license plate that comes back stolen but linked to a different vehicle in the system. A driver who has no sales paperwork, no proof of insurance, or can't produce registration. Examining the MVI sticker for inconsistencies and contacting the listed dealership can also uncover discrepancies. These vulnerabilities show that even businesses built around cars need constant vigilance and strong internal controls. Hashtag tech outro.
Wow. Okay. We have covered an incredible amount of territory today. I mean, really deep.
We definitely did.
From those core legal definitions to private appropriate property and how absolutely crucial effective consent and deception are.
Mm-hmm, the foundations.
Right. Then we climbed that whole theft ladder, looking at how value sets the baseline, but how those specific items and circumstances, those plus one enhancements, can just change the game entirely.
Yeah, showing what society prioritizes protecting.
And then diving into all those specialized offenses, trade secrets, petroleum, mail theft with its identity theft links, organized retail and cargo theft.
Each with its own unique logic and structure.
And finally, that really detailed look at auto theft. The different types of thieves, those intricate dismantling and salvage switch schemes, how investigators use VINs and spot indicators, even the surprising ways dealerships can be vulnerable. It's a lot.
It really is. And if we try to connect all those threads, maybe the bigger picture takeaway is just the sheer precision of it all. It's not just a messy list of don't steal stuff. It's the incredible level of detail and layered intent behind every legal definition.
Yeah.
It really shows how the law tries painstakingly to account for almost every conceivable nuance of human behavior when it comes to property rights, even the most deceptive, most sophisticated criminal methods.
Yeah.
It's trying to draw very fine lines.
So what does all this mean for you listening right now? Well, maybe next time you see one of those shoplifters will be prosecuted signs, or you hear a news report about a car theft ring being busted, or even just, you know, see that rusty bike chained to the pole. Remember all the layers beneath the surface.
The intent, the specific definitions, the presumptions, the investigative work.
Exactly. It's so much more than just taking. And it raises, I think, an important question to ponder. How do these incredibly precise, sometimes complex legal frameworks actually influence our everyday behavior, our understanding of what's ours and what isn't, and our sense of accountability, even for those of us who would never dream of intentionally breaking the law?
That's a great thought to end on. How does knowing these lines exist shape our actions?
Something to think about. We hope this deep dive gave you a whole new appreciation for the intricate world of theft and burglary law. Thanks for joining us.